Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. I'm here today with Michael, and this is Double Feature. So this is a podcast. Let's say this one is as about films as obscure as Fur and as notable as A Dirty Shame.
Don't be a neuter.
So we're going to travel to a new electric dimension today. We have a double feature about, what is it, Tall Grass? Is
that yeah, it's the Tall Grass about? Double feature, which involves the electric dimension that humanity has been wanting for 1,000 years.
Man mows lawn, brain mows lawn, brain mows man, that sort of thing. And what's the other... Oh, so sorry, that's Lawnmower Man.
We're going to cover Lawnmower Man, which right. is Man Mows Lawn, Brain Mows Lawn, followed by Jurassic Park, which right. is Man Creates Dinosaur, Dinosaur Eats Man, Women Inherits the Earth, God something, Gets Destroyed Somewhere in the Middle.
Something to that effect. A couple things. One, if there's giggling in the other room, we're running like a full-scale operation in the studio today. So I have to retroactively credit Gracie for what mixing or engineering our show or whatever the fuck she's doing. In Studio B right over that way, which you can't see, but I'm pointing at. We're recording in here. We have this show. I want to take note that this show is not quite going to be the dispelling of dinosaur myths yeah. that a skeptic show really should be, because that's been done so many places. We want to talk about Jurassic Park as sort of a piece of filmmaking and where it succeeds and what it's notable for there. Yeah.
But first, we're going to get into Lawnmower Man.
Before we even do that, there are going to be spoilers for both films. We're going to spoil Lawnmower Man. We are going to spoil Jurassic Park. Here's the thing. Lawnmower Man, you don't care about, and Jurassic Park, you already know what happens. So we're not really going to spoil either film. If you feel like you could be spoiled by these two films, no.
Chapters.
But there are chapters, so you can use the chapters in the chapters menu on your iPod, iTunes, QuickTime to skip to the appropriate film or to skip to the end of the show where we tell you what the fuck is going on next time. Lawnmower Man is a Jeff Fahey vehicle, right?
Yes, I mean, it is. As again, as far as I know, this is where Jeff Fahey, this is the first thing it's the earliest Jeff Fahey I've seen in his career.
Sure.
And he's pitted against or with, depending on which part in the film you're watching, Pierce Brosnan prior to James Bond fame.
Right.
Basically, the generalized plot of Lawnmower Man is that Pierce Brosnan tried to make a monkey into a super intelligent individual, right. but it went apeshit.
Right.
And instead, he decided to continue his program on Job, played by Jeff Fahey, mm-hmm. who is a simple lawnmower man.
Right. So this sort of starts out our man-playing-god theme that we don't yeah. want to be in the double feature.
Yeah. The original idea for this double feature was supposed to be the definitive, anti-definitive
right.
CG conversation.
Whining about CG, yeah. essentially. But I think we both knew when we planned it out that there's about three sentences we yep. need to say about CG, and the rest is going to be about Frankenstein,
exactly.
apparently. So Jeff Fahey, exploitation fans will know him, of course, as Mr. Barbecue from Planet Terror. Fans of the mystery series Lost will recognize him as one of the Choppies. A term, by the way, that you coined.
I did
and that
coin.
You never
I coined,
got credit for
I
that.
I coined the term Choppies.
I believe what happened is you started using it in our weekly Lost meetings. We had a bunch of people over to do Lost. I called a podcast with the term Choppies, and I believe fandom picked it up from there, and you were never rightly credited.
What the fuck?
So it's been several years now since anyone gave a shit about that, but Michael Kester coined the term Choppies. That
Thank
needs
you.
To go in the Lostopedia there. So the thing I'm wondering is we have these two people. Pierce Brosnan, of course, you know, is Bond.
Mm-hmm.
We know him as the Matador.
Right.
We have these two stories. This is the part that intrigues me the most about Lawnmower Man, is we start this film out, and as you described, it's got, you know, experimenting on monkeys and whatever and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so
super science is
yeah,
going
right,
on.
Right. We have a super soldier serum thing, something virtual reality. Who gives a shit? Pierce Brosnan is sitting in his basement. His girlfriend, wife, whatever, is complaining that he never shows her any affection.
Doesn't take her to the mall.
Right, doesn't take her to the mall, blah, blah, leave your science and buy me some jewelry. So he's working on this big project, which seems really important. And then, you know, we take a break from that. We go to what looks like B story. we go to this kid who's apparently kind of retarded.
Yeah.
And mows lawns.
Yeah.
And
lives at a church.
Right.
Under the supervision of a preacher and his brother.
Sure.
The brother, played by the actor who was in both Super Beasto.
Right.
And also The Devil's Rejects. He played Roy Sullivan in Banjo and Sullivan.
So then we go back to Pierce Brosnan, and he's working on some more science, and he's doing some crazy shit. And we go back and visit Jeff Fahey, and he's mowing some lawns. And this happens for first 20 minutes mm-hmm. of the film. And I'm going, how the fuck are these two things ever going to come together?
Yeah. Turns out there's just one simple thing that you didn't predict, and that's that he just happens to be mowing Pierce Brosnan's neighbor's lawn.
Or right,
Pierce Brosnan's
exactly.
lawn, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Pierce Brosnan just walks out of the house, and
he's like, oh, hey, Job.
I instantly see where this is going.
I need an experiment from you.
So it's not too long until we're exposed to this virtual reality world.
Yes.
I mean, we get it early on, but we start to get it really heavy mm-hmm. when Jeff A.
Reboot world.
Yeah, exactly. It is reboot. If you've seen the cartoon, I mean, a lot of people remember this thing growing up. It was the Saturday morning, like, CGI cartoon.
Yeah, where reboot. People lived inside computers and
right.
people would insert games on them and they would have to fight their way out.
When I was, I had a brief stint living in Toronto, and the chick I was living with up there got this great idea one day. She's like, remember Reboot? That shit was cool. I'm going to download that. And we got like all three seasons or whatever the
you
fuck
you watched it is. Two episodes.
We watched like half of one, and yeah. it was like, this is terrible. So this is not watchable at all. But I remember that show was really funny because they had all these technological terms,
yeah.
which back then no one knew what the fuck they were. But now
gigabyte,
they're like
megahertz,
laughable. Right? Exactly. Yeah. Now they don't make
program
sense in there.
Backslash.
Sure. That's kind of what we're getting here. This world, this VR place, it is the world of Reboot.
Yeah.
And you know, here's the thing. I'm just going to get this graphics thing out of the way right now. I went into this and I'm going, okay, we're pairing this against Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park is the definitive look how much we did for the time and place we were in. And especially for our show. Yeah. I mean, we needed to do this because you invoke Jurassic Park about every three episodes.
Jurassic Park is my definitive look why puppets are better.
And so we get to this VR world and yeah, it's laughable, but I don't actually have a problem with
it. No, see, that's the thing.
And here's why I think it's all right. When it stays within its own world, I accept that that is the world we're in. When we do What Dreams May Come, I accept that he's in Paint World.
Yeah.
Okay? And so we deal with Paint World, and Paint World actually looks kind of cool mm-hmm. in the movie. Kind of cool. I accept the surreal, you know, kind of environment that we're in. So if they want the aesthetic of that world to be a really, really bad N64, like, ROM, I understand that, and I'm fine playing around in that world. The only time it really starts to get on me is when they leave that world and when the bad aesthetic translates into realm of humanity.
When evil Job starts using virtual reality as a weapon, you start running into this like weird, the golden Job head.
Right, yeah.
That's the
first. You know what? Even golden Job head doesn't bother me so much. What really gets me is...
the bees.
Yeah, it's, you know what? It's basically anytime they try to make us believe that it's real life we're seeing.
Yeah.
Golden Job head is sort of like, it's a kind of call over from this world. It's that world coming into ours.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe N64 world doesn't look so great in our world, but I can buy that N64 world is coming into our world. What I don't buy is when they abandon their, their sort of parlor tricks to instead show, you know, the floating chair and the weird telekinesis stuff and to show us instead a bunch of CGBs.
Yeah.
The CGBs, CGBGs, is that what that is? Yeah. No, that's a club in New York.
CBGBs.
That was a club in New York. They're probably the worst looking thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, they're horrible.
Well, here's part of the deal. These things, it's like they got one cartoon drawing of a bee.
Yeah.
And they cut it out and they just copied it 100 times. None of the bees have any variation and they're just shrunk down to this weird size that you're hoping no one will even look at them. But every once in a while you like, actually once in particular, you see a bee close up and it's like an insect or something and it looks terrible.
It's awful.
And no matter how far away the swarm of bees is supposed to get or how close to you, the perspective of them never changes.
They just still look
the
like
the size
blotches.
Doesn't change. Yeah. If the bees are close up, you think they would be bigger on the screen than when they're far away. But they just expand and contract the cloud and move it around. It's terrible. It's absolutely awful.
I think my definitive worst part of the CG brought into the physical world is when Job burns the preacher and he just turns into like the yellow flow dots.
Right, right.
But you can see through him.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to be a person on fire.
Yeah, I don't know what that. As soon as I saw through him, I was like, all right, are we supposed to be N64ing it?
But apparently, because later on, the police are talking about it and they're like, somebody burned the preacher.
Right, yeah. So you don't really know what they're doing there. I'm not sure you can really fault the film for that, but I mean, there is a. No, you can. You absolutely can. There's a point where you should know that your fucking bees suck and you can't actually do that with your film.
The other thing, moving on kind of plot-wise as well through the film that I found to be a... Probably this is my biggest disappointment of the film, is the film goes and it starts with Joe being simple and he slowly gets more intelligent, starts combing his hair, wearing nicer clothes, until he becomes...
And looking less like Trey Parker from Orgasmo. Right. Did you notice this? This was totally driving me crazy.
Yeah.
All right, sorry,
go ahead. So, 3/4 of the way through the film, he... And forgive me for my horror side showing here, but he becomes this awesome thing.
Right, right.
During the scenes where whenever he's doing evil stuff, he glows blue.
Right.
All that is so cool and, like, really iconic for me.
Right.
But the film seems to think that he has one more stage of evolution.
Sure.
And that they're like, oh yeah, you think this is cool? Wait till you see what he becomes.
Sure, sure.
So I'm sitting there watching the film the first time going, oh man, he's gonna start like his eyes will turn red and he's gonna start like floating like fucking Nimrod from X-Men.
Right.
Like this really ultimate evil creature and it could be so cool. But instead he uploads himself into a computer and the big definitive villain shot is like, him looking kind of like a character from Mortal Kombat, roaring at the screen.
Yeah, and that he's bigger than Pierce Brosnan's character on the screen. Yeah, it's kind of silly and
it's
sort of a
letdown.
It's
a big letdown. Because then as this ultimate villain, like even if I could accept that he was cooler this way, the only thing he does is try to decode these little hexagons.
Right, that's his, Yeah, he pulls them out one by one and turns them to see if he'll get a, I don't know what happens here. But I mean, when he finally gets out at the end of this, he comes through a tube and suddenly there's phones ringing. Like, I don't know that that makes any fucking sense.
Well,
I'm not sure that's a great ending for this. I mean, it's more the journey that's, if I could stop off about, I don't know, 20 minutes before this film ends, I have a lot more fun with it. Yeah. I think you see, if we're going to talk about notability, I mean, after all, Double Feature and notability, if we're going to talk about what to take away from this film, I think we can talk about how you take literally the worst graphics of all time and you actually kind of do something with that. You make people buy into that. Having the graphics doesn't necessarily make for the film up until the point where there's CGBs and you're supposed to you're supposed to buy into that. But the film, so you talked about the ending and we make the joke about the Jurassic Park line or whatever, which actually I wrote in my notes before we'd watch Jurassic Park again. So it was like this weird thing kicking in from the last time I watched that. But those are the acts of the film. Man mows lawn, right? That's the beginning.
Yeah.
He's mowing the lawn. He's just a dude. And then brain mows lawn. He gets telekinetic powers. His brain mows the lawn. And then the brain mows man, right?
Yep.
I mean, he becomes a slasher for about 10 minutes of the film. He goes on a crazy rampage. The idea being that they put some kind of crazy government program into the other crazy program, which makes this less of a Frankenstein thing.
Yeah.
It's less of a man shouldn't play God.
Yeah.
It's more of a the government meddled in this plant. Well, so it becomes a little less... moral of the story, a little more popcorn-y. You know?
But I'm going to backtrack to what you just said because I really want to kind of touch on the slasher element that this film has.
Of course you do.
So this film comes out in 1992, kind of still when slasher films count. And it's called The Lawnmower Man. And for some reason, the title, The Lawnmower Man, maybe it's Candyman because of...
I thought this was a slasher film.
Yeah, everyone thinks it's a slasher film. And I don't know
I blame Budget Video, man. You're walking by in Budget Video. You see the cover from Jason 9?
Jason Goes to Hell.
Yeah, and you see
Hellraiser. Yep. You see Candyman. No, not Candyman.
Maybe Candyman.
You see Evil Dead.
Right, yeah. You're making the face thing.
Yeah, with the skull. And Silence of the Lambs with the butterfly over the mouth. Right. Candyman's the one with the bees all over the eye. That's Candyman.
I haven't seen that one, I don't think. Okay. But I associate the two.
This film isn't, for all intents and purposes, it's not really a slasher film. But you could chalk it up just as much if you're just going to go purely by, like, body count.
Right.
Like, this is a character. It's kind of like a slasher prequel.
Right.
And the slasher film.
Sure. It's a slasher film with a lot of depth to it, I guess.
And it's probably a 15-minute section of the film where he just goes through and just kind of really systematically, he's like, you're dead, you're marbles, You know, your lawn mode.
Right. You know, and it seems like something you're really straining to make the 10 minutes of this film, you know, Indo slasher film, but just wait a week, wait 2 weeks, wait 3 weeks and remember back to this film. And for some reason in your head, you're going to go, oh yeah, that's where he went around with the lawnmower. Yeah. I think part of it, you know, he's the lawnmower man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But there's a lot of other stuff this film has going for it. Of course, there's all the, like we said, different sort of mechanical effects and the telekinesis stuff. And by the way, can we just hit on the telekinesis thing really quick?
Yeah, let's hit on it.
I know we're going to be doing this 100 times in this show, but first of all, I don't know about smoking at the gas station. Maybe it's just as dangerous as smoking, you know, near some dry plants.
Yeah.
So let's forget about smoking at the gas station. But this idea that the ancients and the alchemists, you know, had telekinesis long ago, and then beyond that, they chalk something up later to spontaneous combustion. You know what I mean?
I think was a joke about how stupid the cops were.
Yeah, maybe it is. I don't know. I think
regardless, we're still allowed to comment on spontaneous combustion,
and that comment would be
that is total bullshit.
Another thing I think is really cool as far as an aesthetic is the some of these scenes you see. I guess the best way is just to point one out. You remember the diner freakout? The first time these powers are kind of manifesting in him.
Yeah.
He's at the diner with the kid.
He starts hearing people talk.
Right. And he's talking about the box art comic books. And the kid's like, righteous comic books. I'm out of here, man.
That's totally sketch.
Yeah, right. So he takes off and Job totally freaks out. And so the kind of freak out he has almost, it reminds me of like a little bit of that Videodrome sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But then you also get a couple really quick vertigo shots that are cool. We've mentioned the vertigo shots before, but it's something that was made famous in the Hitchcock film, Vertigo. And it's a shot that you get. It basically, your main character stays in focus, in frame, and the same size and proportion, but it appears as if the background is expanding behind him. And you accomplish the shot, and I love this because they do it in both directions, which you don't actually get to see a lot. You accomplish the shot by pulling the camera back. You physically move the camera from a, you know, basically a close-up to a wide shot. You move it really far back and you zoom in at the same time. So what it does, it takes advantage of this really cool thing. It's sort of this lens phenomenon. Basically, you're moving the camera to get a different focal distance, but you're zooming in to maintain the size of your subject that's in focus. So it looks like you're essentially compressing and expanding the background while keeping the foreground exactly the way it was. It's just a really simple practical effect. The guy who found the effect was awesome. And here you see them doing it, both pulling the camera back and zooming in, and then pushing the camera in and zooming out. So it's like the background is just rapidly compressing and expanding behind him. And then on top of that, you get these sort of, you get these kind of chromatic, like red and green splits. And I don't know, the stuff just looks cool. And it's kind of it definitely looks cheap, but it looks cheap in that sort of Cronenberg, you know, Videodrome kind of sense. It establishes a look, and I kind of wish they would have stuck with a little bit more. But had you had that that attention to detail and that foresight to say, let's keep N64 in N64's world and keep humanity, you know, where it belongs, I think this film would have had a much longer shelf life.
Well, I agree.
But I need a real reality, man, not this artificial reality.
Let's get some real goddamn reality.
Why don't we move on to Jurassic Park?
All right, so a quick word about Mr. Steven Spielberg, who I'm sure you've heard of. We covered him once, maybe 15 times, somewhere in between.
I think we've done everything he's ever done.
We've done Duel, I know. We've done The Terminal. Yeah. Well, now I'm not willing to say fully that this is Steven Spielberg's sci-fi, but it's close.
Right.
Steven, so personally, I don't know about your feelings exactly, because I kind of just bombard you with this every time, and I don't give you a chance to refute.
No, that's fine.
But Steven Spielberg doing sci-fi, I think, counts as great cinema. Steven Spielberg doing family films, anything but Hook is debatable. Right.
I think Hook is debatable, my friend, but maybe we'll get into that one day. You hit this early on the show, and we mention this almost every time Spielberg comes up, but I'm just going to rehash it because it still holds fucking true, even though this film accomplishes what I'm about to say much better. Steven Spielberg builds a world, and then he plays in that world. It's a very simple formula, and it works about 100 fucking percent of the time. Even if we don't think it makes for grade A films, the 500 million people who go see his films would beg to differ with us. In Jurassic Park, like any other Spielberg film, we spend the beginning of the Spielberg film saying, here, we're going to this place. Here's your characters. First of all, let's get all the characters out of the way. When do you see a Spielberg film where a character floats in the middle of the second act? Doesn't happen. We get all the characters out of the way. We meet the archaeologists. We meet the dude with the park. We meet the kids. We meet Jeff Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum has his shirt buttoned up because it's still the first half of the film. And then we go to the park and we, oh, there's dinos. Here's how the dinosaurs are here. There's plants.
Look how pretty they are.
Right.
Look at what a good job we did. Can you imagine these expansive shots?
Yeah. And then right about when you're like, okay, Jesus, guys, I get the world. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you never really say that because we could just walk through the park for 2 hours. That's fine. Then the dinos get loose and we're running from the dinos, right? Run away from the T-Rex, run away from the dinosaurs. And so that's kind of the formula. The question here becomes, why does this, and I think most people agree with this is one of his biggest films.
Yeah.
Why does the formula work so much better here than in a movie like The Terminal?
I think the answer, and I'm going to lump Minority Report and AI into the same category as Jurassic Park.
Films that, by the way, right, use the exact same fucking formula?
Yeah, they do. But the thing is, and it's very, very, very specific, and I think it has to do with the sci-fi angle. And it's that Steven Spielberg is better at creating worlds that don't exist or that are like incredibly fascinating.
Sure, I see what you're saying.
And on top of that, once he creates basically his own version of a world, he can make a much more in-depth and interesting story. When he creates a world where somebody's stuck at an airport, he'll do the best he can with a someone stuck at the airport story, but no matter who you are, somebody stuck at an airport can't be as interesting as somebody running from a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Okay, but here's the weird thing about that. The first half of The Terminal, as we discussed on the show, The Terminal is a movie about a guy stuck in an airport. Somehow the first half where we explore the airport is really interesting.
It is.
Why is that? We're just exploring an airport.
It's because Steven Spielberg understands, like, in a world, what people really would just like to see happen.
Sure.
And kind of what they can identify with the characters doing. Like in Jurassic Park, you have these characters who are introduced to an all-dinosaur environment.
Sure.
Spielberg essentially goes, if the viewer were these characters, what would they want to be shown?
Okay.
How would they want it to be shown to them?
Right.
And that's why you get a tour, you get half a tour, but then you kind of break out of the tour because you're so interested that you have to see it close up.
Sure.
You see dinosaurs from far away. Mm-hmm. You end up like kind of, you see a sick one, you interact with it.
Right.
And then the plot begins.
So before we hit on the plot, let's tackle that whole building this world thing, because I think as one of the best worlds he's ever created, that's certainly worth analyzing. The first thing you see is not a dinosaur, but sort of. I mean, they're kind of delivering one.
Right.
He's giving, you know, everyone wants to go to this film to see dinosaurs. I remember when this thing came out, it was like, hey, dinosaurs, you want to see live real dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Go to see Jurassic Park. I remember a lot of people I knew couldn't go to it because their parents were like, this is too scary. You're staying home, you know? So he knows his rule. He knows don't show the monster first. I mean, this is, you know, Mr. Jaws after all. We do see the monster. We see quite a bit of the monster. And in a lot of ways, I think this is sort of the antithesis of Jaws. Here it's about, look at the monster, look how awesome he is. But he still knows how to tease his audience.
Yeah.
He still knows how to show a dinosaur being delivered and just kind of show the eyes.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I want to see what's in there so bad. Oh, we have to go visit a dig site.
Yeah.
Oh, boo.
Yeah, he's kind of like, you want to see the dinosaur? Here it is as a skeleton.
Yeah, right. Here's what you wish you could see. Well, the other thing I'm curious about in the beginning of this film, I mean, everybody rips on it for the bad science and what's debatable about the science, because part of the scientific method is you revise your opinion as new evidence is presented.
Mm-hmm.
And now a lot of what's in Jurassic Park is even more inaccurate than when it originally came out, because we find out all these new things about dinosaurs. Again, this isn't the dinosaurs
podcast, and cloning. So. Cloning has come such a long way in the past 15 years
That was the big thing when that came out, is everyone was like, ah, this is kind of a dubious method for recreating dinosaurs. And you sort of wonder about your suspension of disbelief there. I'm always a fan of get the science dead on, because if you know, just talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think is always my recommendation, because that guy can make fucking anything sound amazing. He is the Carl Sagan of our generation. Science, if you know the right people to talk to and the right stuff to look at, is so much more interesting than anything Clive Barker could ever dream of.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
But here I kind of wonder if this whole process they show and all of the misinformation, I don't want to credit this stuff because that's obviously, you know, the opposite of what I'm about. But doesn't that kind of build the world? I mean, part of that mystique of the, even if it is misinformation, people like this movie because they think they're learning about dinosaurs.
That's part of it. But the other thing that's just really strong about the film is, if you're going to take a film where people are being chased by dinosaurs, it makes it so much better if you can believe that there's dinosaurs. It'd be another thing if they're like, we found a frozen T-Rex and it had dinosaurs with it.
I don't know, though. You know, you think about the plants. I mean, yeah. Maybe of course the plants are less of a big deal, but they do with the plants what we accept with monster films all the time.
Right.
There's a monster. Okay, where's our film?
Right.
You know, okay, we've accepted there's a monster. We're going to do something from here. I think dinosaurs could show up in this movie and we would be like, all right, dinosaurs. And we would just move on. Maybe because in the same way with the plants. That's why I mentioned the plants. They make a point of these plants, you know, have been extinct for a bajillion years. I believe 1 bajillion years is how long the, I don't remember. All I remember from this film is fucking chaos theory. But they never tell us how they get the plants back. They tell us how they get dinosaurs.
Right.
And everybody on sitting out on the couch here.
The blood of the plants.
Right, right. Well, I was going to go with plants as fossils and dinosaur poop.
Right.
But that was
either or.
I don't think that hypothesis is
plants
any better.
As fossils and mosquito poop.
So that doesn't bother us about the plants. Is the only reason because we don't give a shit about plants?
People...
If they didn't tell us about where the dinosaurs came from, we'd be let down.
Come on. Look at this objectively. You're asking me about plants in a movie that's about dinosaurs.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. You're totally right. I'm just kind of curious why... You know, if that bad science is necessary, I guess you do kind of want it. What it serves as a plot point or as a character device is to find these people who are really interested in dinosaurs. And then they want to go, you know, how do you have dinosaurs?
Right.
And so it's more about exploring, you know, their sort of their wonder and awe at how this process worked rather than actually giving us, you know, the whatever device from Thank You for Smoking.
Right.
It's not like, oh, the killer's after us and our cell phone doesn't have reception. You know, it's like, here's dinosaurs and we're going to show you, you know, this funny little infomercial with some like dubious science.
Right.
Just to show you the shock and amazement of our protagonist here.
Right.
One of our protagonists is Jeff Goldblum.
Yes.
Who I love and adore. Jeff Goldblum has a million films, 3 of which anyone cares about. But for some reason, I could just watch Jeff Goldblum day and night.
He's just got it going on.
This film is probably what the women in our circle will coin the hottest Goldblum outside of Earth Girls Are Easy.
Probably.
Which is kind of awkward, actually. Yeah. I'm not really sure how I feel about that. But when he's not spending the film with his shirt open, and why I even buy that and accept that... is because this is one of my most memorable Jeff Goldblum moments of all time. He seduces this guy's wife while explaining chaos theory.
Right.
And he's using, you know, the imperfections in her hands to kind of flirt with her. Chaos theory I like because it's just like a more insane extension of the butterfly effect. If you've seen the film, you know what it is. But it's, you know, butterfly flaps its wings in South America and there's a tornado in China, right? It's that these small details can have a chain reaction. And chaos theory kind of focuses on... the improbability of that basically we can't know for certain what's going to happen in a situation where we're dealing with large numbers or basically a lot of variables.
Right.
I mean, it's cool to think about how a small change can set off a sort of chain reaction that'll ultimately result in a more significant event. But chaos theory is largely driven by a misconception regarding the butterfly effect. The butterfly effect is about what's possible, not what's probable. Many people have this misconception that if you went back in time and changed something, it would certainly have a great impact on the future you return to.
Yeah.
In truth, there's potential for that, but it's by no means a guarantee. Michael Shermer's done some fantastic writing on the subject. There's a chapter in his book, Science Friction, that talks about how unlikely it is for a random change in the past to have any, you know, significant event on the present. When you think about it, chaos theory almost unintentionally undoes the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he talks about how there's so many variables that to go back in time and change just one will have little or no actual impact in the long term. A variable in another place in time would likely fill in the gap you left when you changed a variable yourself. It's really complicated stuff, so I don't want to go into too much of a tangent here, but he gives some great examples and expands on it a lot in that book. If you want to look it up, it's Michael Shermer is the name of the author. And the book's called Science Friction, F-R-I-C-T-I-O-N. And you can grab it on Audible if you just want to listen to them. We haven't plugged our Audible thing in a while, but you can get Science Friction for free from us by signing up through our site. It's bookshow.doublefeatureshow.com. And I think it's the last chapter of the audiobook that talks about all this. It's the chapter called What If? Anyways, I was going somewhere with all this chaos theory stuff. Oh, so that kind of leads me into my question of what the fuck happened with this park. If we're going to examine the Frankenstein kind of equation here, man shouldn't play God, Is it man's fault for toying with dinosaurs that we got a bunch of dinosaurs running loose? Well, and
you know,
do you just blame Newman from Seinfeld? I mean, whose fault is it that this park ended up this way?
The thing that I like about the film is that in the very beginning, when they're first kind of giving the tour,
mm-hmm.
there's Samuel L. Jackson's "Hold on to your butts," and
yeah,
then,
no one remembers he's in this.
And then the tour starts, and he just starts chalking up all these bugs
right.
in the system. He's
151
like this,
lines of bugs,
and even though they all seem small. You have bugs like, oh, you know, the trucks don't lock.
Right.
Which
right.
seems like a big issue, but sure. at the same time, not something you'd think of.
Right.
And all of this starts kind of going, I can see this is going to snowball into something. Right. But as much as that seems like it's implicit in the film,
uh-huh.
the major problem is that they have an inside man.
Yeah.
An inside man who's looking for money, and he's just and he screws the park.
So you think the bugs are kind of a misnomer here?
Well, I think that they can be attributed to increasing the problem.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, think of the film from the objective standpoint. They could have no locks on the trucks. Ooh, right. that's a problem. They just got out. They could have locks on the trucks. Oh, there's a T-Rex eating them, and sure. they can't get out of the car.
Right. So you kind of need your safeguards in place, but you wouldn't blame them for... I know it's anecdotal, but man, I forgot a fucking semicolon when I was programming this thing on Awesome Start yesterday. Our site was down for like 6 hours.
Yeah.
Just the smallest fucking wrench in the planet. It's chaos theory again, right? Yeah, so I guess I do kind of, I blame Newman for this.
You got to. One thing about this film that I know everybody thought we were going to make it all the way through without me mentioning, but the dinosaurs yes. in this film. I'll admit the film has some CG.
Uh-huh.
Granted, that CG does not look that bad.
It's pretty good. I actually think the worst CG in the whole film is the first dinosaur.
The first dinosaur, yeah.
And I think I'm looking at that objectively. Yeah. I don't think that's just because it's the first yeah. one, but man, they put it right in broad daylight. And
it's, you know, gigantic. There's people in the frame.
People who know stuff about music like John Williams. So I'm just going to chalk that up to I don't know what I'm talking about. I know he did Star Wars and stuff yeah. and Indiana Jones and whatever. Fuck John Williams. I'm right. sorry. This movie could be so much more special to me. And instead, it has a boring classic orchestral score.
I really like the score.
Anyway, yeah, well. You know what? I don't mind the writing. I guess it's just because it sounds like a cheesy orchestra yeah, score yeah. that I could now replicate on a Radio Shack keyboard. And
the
that bothers me.
The one thing
me.
That I like better than the score is, oh, yeah. is the dinosaur puppetry that goes on throughout the film.
I know something you like even better than that. But talk about the puppetry a little
so
bit.
So the thing about this fucking puppetry is that we watched... This film comes out in 1993. The year after Lawnmower Man
right.
comes out.
Right.
We watched it 15 more years later.
Right.
And one of these two films looks, as Eric put it so gracefully, uh-huh. like an N64 game.
It certainly
particularly
does.
Particularly
like
maybe,
you forgot to blow in the cartridge,
like,
actually.
Like, kind of looks like, oh, maybe fighting Andross.
Okay.
However, another one of these films... looks like there's a fucking dinosaur in it.
About to eat your face.
One of them looks, still, 15 sure. some odd years later, looks fucking real. Because, yeah. and you know why it's real?
Why?
Eric, can you answer why it's real?
Sound, I think, is what I was going to say. But sorry, that's not the answer you want. You want puppets.
Yeah, I want because it's real. It's there. The actors see it. The actors can touch it. And it's in our world.
Turok could spear it with
Turok
a
could
fucking...
spear it.
Right, okay.
Or the chick from Dino Crisis, redhead Lara Croft, could just
yeah,
blow
yeah,
it away.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, the other thing that I think I do love more than the puppets in this
is
film.
Sound. It really is. The sound mix on this...
Kittysaurus Rex.
Right. I'm not going to say it's the most incredible Foley job of all time.
No.
I'm not even going to say it's maybe that innovative, but the idea of taking real animal sounds, I mean, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It is pretty ingenious. Maybe because it's so much fun, I don't
yeah.
want to give it that much credit. You literally, open up a cat sound in like, you know, SoundForge or whatever the fuck that is, and you just like tweak knobs and draw it out, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You just fuck with sound. It's making industrial music.
Yeah. And then
you know
you're
what I mean?
Done, and you go, huh, that's a T-Rex.
yeah,
and
right.
then you click the little button to remove all the effects that you added, and it's like, meow.
yeah, right. So they use these animal noises for all the dinosaurs, and they match them up really, really well. And then actually mixing the sound into the film, they're loud and they're bassy, and we do have to give credit to Foley here. I mean, it's really, really mm-hmm. good, and it's what makes a lot of these scenes really frightening. Even the characters are frightened by the sound of the dinosaurs.
Right.
The one last thing I kind of wanted to ask you about,
please,
myself at least, and you can just bow your way out of this by saying that's just how you feel and fuck you. But I remember when we talked about The Exorcist. When I monologued about The Exorcist,
I recall.
Once upon a time, and I gave it shit because the moments just sort of they startled you, they spooked you out, and they didn't stay with you at all. You weren't frightened beyond the theater. I believe I compared it to 28 Weeks Later and how horrified the both of us were leaving the theater and checking under our car for zombies. Everybody knows dinosaurs aren't hiding under your bed, right? Yeah. I mean, we know once we leave the theater, there's no fucking dinosaurs. It's not like we come back to Chicago and dinosaurs are tearing apart the buildings. That's Jurassic Park 3. So why are we so horrified by these dinosaurs? And is that legitimate?
It's partially because they're real. Partially because they did exist. They're from this Earth. And because there seems to be a scientific process that brings them back.
Okay. So that's playing into our bigger, again, our Frankenstein fear here. It's what could science make?
And
which, by the way, we haven't hit that, but that's totally invalid. Yeah. Fuck that. Yeah. All science that could happen on an infinite fucking scale is going to happen.
Yep.
The A-bomb is going to be created, whether we make it or not. The virus that could wipe everybody out, the push of a button, is going to be made, whether we make it or not. I mean, there's 7 billion people on the Earth, and all science is going to be done. So this question that they raise briefly of... you know, when they're all sitting around at the table, should we do this?
It's John Hammond versus Ian Malcolm. They kind of have this weird head-to-head where Ian Malcolm plays the Geraldo to John Hammond's John Hammond.
Right. I was curious to see where you're going to go with that.
And John Hammond is like, well, I made this park. And Ian Malcolm's like, are you sure that was a good idea? Why would you do that?
Right.
Think of what you're doing to the people.
Sure.
And John Hammond's like, I thought we owed it to science to make dinosaurs. Right. And John Malcolm's like, but you're not, or Ian Malcolm's like, you're not God.
Yeah, right.
You're John Hammond. You're not God.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum has a bit of a problem with it. And I think that stuff's just wrong. I think you just got to do the science. If we can, you know, this crops up every once in a while. Maybe we can bring the woolly mammoth back should scientists do it. Not only should scientists fucking do it, but we should make woolly mammoths and then cook them and eat them, right? That's exactly where I was going with that. I've been a vegetarian for like 13 years. I would eat a woolly mammoth in a fucking heartbeat. Getting back to scary, though. You know, one of the scenes that always hits home for people is the kitchen scene.
The kitchen scene.
We were kind of curious as we were watching that, why is that the most horrifying scene? Because, you know, the dinosaurs, there's going to be a slight Cloverfield spoiler in here, I think. So, you know, I'll peace out if you haven't seen Cloverfield. The dinosaurs are in this kitchen environment, and part of it is that the, even though there's a giant Tyrannosaurus Rex outside, some of them can spit acid, whatever, the reason the Velociraptors are horrifying beyond that they're quote-unquote intelligent and can open doors, not even going to get into that, is that we have kitchens.
Yeah.
We are in kitchens. Yeah. There's one right fucking over
inside.
There.
They're inside. It's because that's
home for us.
The first part of the film is, oh, they're stuck in a car. Oh, they're stuck in a tree.
Tall grass.
Oh, they're stuck by the forest. Right. Oh, they're stuck near a waterfall. But now they're stuck in a kitchen.
Right. I don't drive through Jurassic Park on my way to work, so I'm not horrified.
Right.
I also don't drive to work or drive.
Yeah.
Or is there really a Jurassic Park? But I think you understand what I'm saying. You know, the tall grass doesn't freak us out. Maybe if we lived somewhere that had really tall grass and we hung out in it all the time. But kitchens, kitchens, they are scary. And there's sharp utensils, and there's helpless children, and there's dinosaurs. There is sound, there is Foley, and there is incredible visuals, and they're still really fucking scary. The Cloverfield thing I wanted to mention here is, Cloverfield spoilers, get the fuck out of here, bye. Skip ahead, there's chapters. This is the last thing I want to say. Do you have anything else to say about this movie?
I like the scene where the water vibrates. Done.
One of the things that is so terrifying about Cloverfield, there's a giant monster. I think you already know where I'm going with this. There's a giant T-Rex roaming the city, and it's big, and you can run away from it. And that's all fine and good. We get over the giant T-Rex in like the first 30 minutes. We don't care that it's going through the city, destroying the buildings. What we do care about is then there's a bunch of smaller T-Rexes that fall off of it and chase us through the fucking subway.
Yep.
And that's terrifying. Here, as soon as you get away from the T-Rex, you're like, oh, it's big, it can't see me, there's only a couple around the island.
They make the T-Rex this powerful, like, creature of, like, destruction, but they give it the clear weakness, it can't see you if you don't move.
Sure,
it looks at light.
Makes us all feel safe.
It's gigantic, it's a little bit slow.
And right when they get over the bridge there, there's like a little tunnel thing for the water that the girl could clearly hide in.
Right.
But then you have to remember that you can't hide in small spaces because there's velociraptors everywhere and they will eat you.
Mm-hmm.
If the giant dinosaurs don't get you, the tiny dinosaurs will get you. And if they don't get you, then that Jeff Goldblum with his unbuttoned shirt will surely
sheen you to death.
So I guess we're never going to invoke Jurassic Park again. Are we done with that?
Never, Models ever, cool. ever until at least next week.
Okay. What's coming up next week?
Next week we're going to cover Candyman and Beetlejuice.
What are those movies?
Candyman and Beetlejuice are both films where you say the title character's name multiple times.
Some might argue that this is the weakest idea for a pairing of a double feature ever. How would you respond to that?
Just wait and see. I think you'll be surprised.
All right, I got a better one for you. This is about legend. It is about myth. It's about fairy tale. It's something we're very concerned with around here. We really love our mythos. So I think this is going to be a really fun one to dive into.
One of us is going to dress up like Candyman and the other one's going to dress up like Beetlejuice and we're going to duke it out.
I'm going to, first of all, we both know that I would be Beetlejuice and you would be Candyman because you have a pimp coat and a hook and I have an email address and it's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com where you could send me a picture of myself photoshopped as Beetlejuice or something. Wait, and you know what? No, fuck that. Send me a picture of Michael Keaton photoshopped to look like me. I would like that much better. Or just send us some feedback. That's fine. If you have legitimate feedback, a much better place for that would be iTunes. Also, we had two really amusing donations this week. One was from our new hot military contractor friend, Sheila. She'll be running the burlesque show. She enjoys roller derby, bear juice, and long walks on the Virginia beach. We also got a donation from a freak show attraction known only as the Mysterious Canadian Beaver. Beaver Greg, as we'll call him, decided to play a drinking game that quickly turned into some kind of gambling game that then evolved into him just sending us his money. So thanks to these two, we're one step closer to soundproofing this studio. If you want to send us a donation, you can click the donate button on the right-hand side of our website. Now, speaking of which, we have a website.
Yeah.
It's doublefeatureshow.com where you can find a lot of the goddamn movies we do. So here's, okay, so this is a fun little thing that's on doublefeatureshow.com. You can find an itemized list, an A to Z list of every film we've ever featured on the fucking show. So if you don't act, if you're one of those people who uses the glorious chapter feature to skip Cloverfield spoilers and films you haven't actually seen, you will love this list. You can just buzz through, you can try and find movies you like, and you can just download that shit in iTunes and open up and go right to the one you want. The other thing you can do is search the website to find shit we reference all the time, like Blade Runner, for instance, because you realize we will never talk about Blade Runner, but you want to hear us talk about it for hours on end. You can just find all the shows where we name drop Blade Runner for 3 seconds. If you know, that's what gets you off.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.